It's my pleasure to invite Professor Dr. K. Maheshwaran Nair from the Department of Sanskrit at the University of Kerala, and he's also the director of the Center for Vedanta Studies here at the same university. And his field of study is Vedanta. Will that be Advaita? Advaita Vedanta. And so today he's been here for about 2 weeks now? Or
14, 13.
So he's been training some of our students in Sanskrit readings through various texts. And it's a privilege to have you here. And he's going to talk to us about Advaita Vedanta in Bhartruhari's Vakyapadiya. And you have a synopsis or an abstract in front of you. So the floor is yours, and welcome to the center.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I will have to leave in about 5 minutes, but if you don't mind,
it's okay.
I know, and it's not very auspicious thing to do in the traditional.
Yeah. Yes. So I have something prepared. So first I'll go through the prepared matter, and towards the end I'll add something more. Bhartruhari, the grammarian, was an important philosopher of India. His date is a matter of dispute. Scholars generally agree that his date is the 5th century AD. He is the author of Vakyapadiya, a work on grammatical philosophy, and a commentary on Patanjali's Mahabhashya, the famous work of Panini's grammar. He is also credited with a collection of poems, namely Niti Shataka, Shringara Shataka, and Vairagya Shataka. There have been discussions on the relationship between Bhartruhari and the philosophy of Advaita Vedanta. His philosophy of grammar is explicitly based on the concept of non-dual Brahman. In place of Advaita Vedantic Brahman, one will see the term Shabda Brahman in Vakyapadiya. A comparative study of Vakyapadiya and Advaita Vedanta is not within the scope of the present paper. What is intended is an inquiry into the philosophy of Vakyapadiya. The structure of Vakyapadiya is as follows. The first chapter deals with very general, though rather metaphysical, issues concerning language. It refers to the linguistic basis of the universe. Some commentators have called this chapter the Brahma Kanda. The second chapter deals with the philosophy of grammar, the relation between sentences and words, between sequenceless and sequential, between the universal and the particular, and between form and meaning. This chapter has been referred to as the Vakya Kanda. Some commentators think that Bhartruhari concluded his work with the last stanza, that is 485 of this chapter. The third chapter, running into two parts, discusses the properties of words such as jati, dravya, bhuyodravya, sambandha, kriya, kala, purusha, sankhya, upagraha, linga, and vritti. This chapter is referred to by some as the Padakanda. It also is known as Prakirna or Miscellany. Gaudapada is the first historically known author in the Advaita Vedanta tradition. His work Gaudapada Kairika is available to us. Gaudapada is traditionally said to have been the guru of Govinda Bhagavat Pada, who was the guru of Shankaracharya. Gaudapada Kairikas constitute an expository text on the Mandukya Upanishad. The Gaudapada Kairikas are divided into four books, namely Prakaranas, titled Agama Prakarana, Vaidadhya Prakarana, Advaita Prakarana, and Alata Shanti Prakarana, respectively. The Kairikas of the first book are found interspersed with the prose passages of the Mandukya Upanishad. while the other three books are separate and at the same time dealing in continuation with the theme of the first book. Gaudapada set forth the basic tenets of Advaita Vedanta. Sri Shankara elaborated the philosophy through his commentaries on the Prasthanatraya and a number of works of his own. Later Acharyas continued the tradition of developing Advaita Vedanta into a full-fledged philosophy. What is primary reality? Advaita Vedantic answer to the question is a peculiar one. Brahman is the sole supreme reality according to Advaita Vedanta. Brahman is absolute. In fact, Advaita Vedanta views reality in its three grades. These grades are the Paramarthika, Vyavaharika and Pradibhasika. Brahman is pure existence, consciousness and bliss. Brahman alone has absolute reality. The world has practical reality. Mirage and the like are phenomenal realities. Both the practical and phenomenal realities are related in Brahman through avidya or maya. A common misunderstanding is that Advaita Vedanta denies the world reality. In fact, Advaita Vedanta assigns to the world absolute worldly reality, laukika paramarthikatva, that is the word used in Vedanta Paribhasha. What Advaita Vedanta says time and again is that the world is illusory. Illusoriness and unreality are not to be confused. Are we then to draw the conclusion that Advaita Vedanta accepts more than one reality? No. Advaita Vedantic grades of reality are not divergent spatially or temporally. Spatially and temporally, there is only one reality in Advaita Vedanta, and that is Brahman. All other realities are merely superimposed on Brahman. This does not mean that Brahman is limited by space and time. There is no space or time outside or independent of Brahman. The very word Brahman or Atman is interpreted in such a way as to mean all-pervasive and eternal. There is no spatial or temporal reality other than Brahman. The world is real for all practical purposes. Advaita Vedanta has no objection to assign any kind of reality to anything other than Brahman as long as it does not affect the spatial and temporal reality of the sole, supreme, single Brahman. Does Advaita Vedanta admit of the existence of the world? The answer again is that it does not admit of the spatial or temporal existence of the world on a par with that of Brahman. We are to presume from this that Advaita Vedanta has no plain and simple answer to any of the philosophical questions. When we say that Brahman alone has spatial and temporal reality, there arises the question, is there quality in Brahman? Advaita Vedanta holds that Brahman is devoid of all qualities whatsoever. How can then there be spatiality and temporality in Brahman? The answer is still complicated. The spatial and temporal reality of Brahman is accepted in the sense that there is no space or time outside of Brahman. Really speaking, there is nothing other than Brahman. Advaita Vedanta speaks of realization of Brahman as the summum bonum of human life. How can Brahman be realized? Advaita Vedanta brings in the Kanthagraiveya Nyaya in this connection. Kanthagraiveya Nyaya is that one who is ignorant of the necklace one wears on one's neck realizes towards the close of his search that it is there. Since Brahman is the only temporal reality, we are all Brahman already. But we do not know this fact. It is because of avidya or ajnana or ignorance. On eradication of ignorance, Brahman is realized in the same manner as one realizes the fact that the necklace he was wearing was there on his neck. In answer to all questions, ultimately, Advaita Vedanta has only one refrain. It is Brahman. Indeed, as is said in the Mundaka Upanishad, this world was Brahman itself in the beginning. Brahman itself is reached in the end. All this is verily Brahman. Brahman is the immortal one in the east, Brahman in the west, Brahman in the south and the north. Brahman extends itself below and above. Brahman is this magnificent great universe. Shankaracharya says, all this world is verily Brahman. There is nothing other than Brahman. If anything seems to be there, it is an illusion, just like the mirage seen in the desert. Bhartrihari answers at the very outset of his Vakyapadiya the fundamental question in Advaita philosophy. How is it that the one becomes many? Brahman has neither beginning nor end. The words used by Bhartrihari are anadinidhanam. Similarly, it is the language principle, shabda tattva, the permanent syllable, akshara. It turns into the objects of knowledge, vivartate. From it occurs the manifestation of the world. Actually speaking, the word vivarta is used in the very same sense as it is used in Vedanta. The ultimate reality is transcendent and immanent. All our worldly transactions begin on the basis of time and space, and the Supreme Brahman is beyond both. All the seeming multifarious manifestations are by way of vivarta, which has both beginning and end. This approach of Bhartrihari is in accordance with his grammatical philosophy, in which the structure of linguistic reality is conceived as unitary and indivisible, akhanda, the same word used in Advaita Vedanta also in the same sense, and refers to a single monistic reality, Shabda Brahman. Madhavacharya in his Sarvadarshana Sangraha explains as follows. Brahman is the object denoted by all words, and this object has many varieties imposed upon it in accordance with each particular form. But the differences produced by illusory conditions are only the result of ignorance. Non-duality is the real state. But through the power of concealment and at the time of use of words, a manifold expansion takes place. Bhartrihari describes this nature of Brahman in the second verse of the Brahma.
Sorry, can I interrupt? You were quoting from Madhavacharya?
Sarvadarshana Sangraha of Madhavacharya, yeah. Where he deals with Bhartrihari's theory on language. It is one and the only truth, the second verse of the Brahmakanda of Bhakipati. It is one and the only truth, Ekameva, which is being heard, Yadamnadam, having taken differences by itself, Bhinnam, due to its powers, Shaktivyapashrayat. Even though there is no difference from the powers, Apratatvepi Shaktipya appears as if there is difference. Pratatvena Iva Vartate. The sources of difference in worldly objects, Bhava Bhedasya Yonaya, these are the words used by Bhartrihari in his Vakyapadiya, are the transformations of the sort of origin, etc. Janmatayo Vikara. By attributing fractions, Athyahita Kalam, on it, depending upon the power of time, Kala Shakti Mupashrita. On examining Vakyapadiya in this manner, one can see all the basic tenets of Advaita Vedanta in it, especially in its Brahmakanda. Bhartrihari's philosophy of Vakyapadiya was further developed by the Advaita Vedantins in detail, of course, peeling off its cover of grammar. It may also be noted in this connection that the terms used by Bhartrihari in Vakyapadiya have been conveniently at times distorted semantically by the later Advaita Vedantins. So, the summum bonum of Advaita Vedanta is there's a couplet attributed to Acharya Sundara Pandya, whose works have not come down to us. Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya Jivo Brahmaiva Mahapara. This is the sum total of the principles deliberated in Advaita Vedanta. Brahman alone is real, and everything else is superimposed on Brahman, unreal. And this Brahman is Nirgunam, Niranjanam, Niravevam, Satchitananda Lakshanam. You see, it has no quality at all, devoid of all qualities. And the stress of Advaita Vedanta is therefore on Brahman, which has no quality at all, and at the same time, which is of the nature of Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Even though the Advaita Vedantins say repeatedly that Brahman is qualityless, they always stress on the point that Brahman is Sat, Chit, and Ananda. And also, see, they have a stress on Ananda. Actually speaking, Brahman is Nirgunam, Niranjanam, Niravayam. But every time they have a stress on Anandam of Brahman. Anandam Brahmano Vidvan Nabibheti Kutaschana. See, the Ananda nature of Brahman is stressed in Advaita Vedanta. Here in Vakyapadiya, in Bhartrihari's Vakyapadiya Brahmakanda also, of course, Brahman is the sole supreme ultimate reality. But this Brahman is of the nature of Shabda. It's not in the form described by the Advaita Vedantins in Advaita Vedanta. Namely, this Brahman is Shabda Brahman. So the difference between Advaita Vedanta and Vakyapadiya is in this, in the use of these two words. Wherever you find Brahman in Advaita Vedanta, there you can, you see, give or exchange the word with Shabda Brahman in Vakyapadiya. So Shabda Brahman, and also the very same nature of the universe. The nature of the universe is that it is superimposed on Brahman. It has only practical validity, not ultimate reality. And this superimposition of the world on Brahman is as such accepted in Vakyapadiya also. But how? Not directly. You see, here also the concept of Shabda is brought in. Vivartate artha bhavena. See, Shabda Brahman transcends into, takes the shape of, illusory shape of the entire world, the entire universe. Vivartate artha bhavena. So ultimately, in the concept of Vakyapadiya also, Brahman is real, and this Brahman is in the nature of Shabda, not like the Brahman of the Advaita Vedantins who say that Brahman is Ashabdam, Arupam, Avyayam. This much is the difference between Advaita Vedanta and the Advaita Vedanta of Bhartrihari in Vakyapadiya. Actually speaking, before the origin of even Gaudapada's Sankhya, Gaudapada's Mandukya Karikas, there existed this Vakyapadiya, and therefore Advaita Vedanta and its origin is much indebted to Vakyapadiya. That is my contention. And now the argument is for discussion. You can counter argue. So, but this fact is not usually mentioned in any of the books dealing with either Advaita Vedanta or Bhartrihari's philosophy. Actually speaking, Bhartrihari has to be considered to be the first Advaita Vedantin.
This is a question, sort of. I remember having heard somewhere that that and maybe you can clarify whether that is true. And if it is true, maybe explain why it is like that. That I remember having heard that Shankara, in his commentary on the Brahma Sutra, that maybe you can also clarify, that that he refers to the Bhartrihari's sort of Spottavada and then rejects it entirely and gives a lot of criticism to it. So it seems that he, if that is true, that he was aware of it, but sort of for some reason totally rejected it and sort of referred to the Mimamsaka theory of language over his theory of language. I remember when I heard that, I was sort of surprised, because we see so many parallels between Shankara and Vakyapadiya that you would think that he would sort of take that over.
But you are correct. But in this manner, you see, some scholars have approached Shankara. And the most important among them was D.P. Chattopadhyaya. To his credit, there are several books: Indian Philosophy, A Popular Introduction, What is Living and What is Dead in Indian Philosophy. Several such books are there. This Chattopadhyaya made one lecture at Bangalore University, and this has been published. I don't exactly remember the name of the book. It's Two Trends in Indian Philosophy. Two Trends in Indian Philosophy. His lecture at Bangalore University, in which he puts forward the view that actually speaking, Shankara is indebted to whomever he deities, especially in the case of Buddha. See, Shankara, whom Shankara retorted at his bust. It was Buddha whom Shankara retorted at his bust. He never spared any line without criticizing or denying the viewpoints of Buddha. But this Buddha is the most Buddha is one to whom Sri Shankara is the most indebted. That is the contention put forward by Chattopadhyaya in the Two Trends of Indian Philosophy. Because what Gautama Buddha put forward was as such taken absorbed by Sri Shankara in his philosophy. And at the same time, he denied Buddhism. It was this.
Can you give some examples?
Because the very concept of this Brahman, for example, in the Buddhist concept also, among the Vijnanavadins, of course, it is the same. What is claimed by the Vijnanavadins is the same as claimed by the Advaita Vedantins. Meaning, in the sense, Vijnanam Brahma, Vijnanam Brahma, Sat, Chit, Anandam, in all the three, of course, Chaitanyam is stressed by the Vijnanavadins. Anandam is stressed by the Advaita Vedantins. That is the only difference. See, you can argue and counter argue. So, the spirit of Buddhism was absorbed by Sri Shankara, and Buddhism is considered as one of the non-orthodox systems of Indian philosophy, and because of the same fact, such comparisons are very few. Shankara's dependence on Buddhism, this has not been much analyzed.
About Samkhya, I think he was way more forceful, you know, vis-à-vis the Samkhya. So do you think he proceeded in the same way? He accepted lots of tenets from the Samkhya Vedanta?
Yeah, it's crystal clear when you go through the Yoga Sutra and also the Sankhya Sutra or the Sankhya Karikas. Of course, you can understand that the entire Sankhyan philosophy has been absorbed into the Advaita Vedanta.
At the end of his Brahma Sutra, I think 2.2, at the end of the section,
yeah,
he criticized both. He says the Sankhyans and the Yogins,
yeah,
are dualists. They do not see the reality of the self.
Yeah.
He rejects them at once.
But
he's categorically opposed.
Yeah, it
but
is.
I agree.
The,
it's
the,
yeah,
of the Samkhya.
But it's correct when you take into
take?
Yeah, it's correct when you take into account Shankara's commentary on the Brahma Sutra alone. Mr. Janathan asked to read Sankhya Sutras also for him. And I have started reading it, preparing myself. And I have reached the conclusion that these Sankhya Sutras are of later origin. These Sankhya Sutras cannot be ascribed to Kapila. Because these Sankhya Sutras represent, actually speaking, pure Advaita Vedanta. So, I don't know. See, since I have this Advaita Vedantic background, and I know... at the moment, I have no difficulty to read and follow the Sankhya Sutras. I approached these sutras, strictly speaking, without any bias, but now I understand that it's entirely Advaita Vedanta. So,
do they uphold the view that there's only one Purusha or many Purushas?
One Purusha. Parama Purusha.
Yeah.
So there's no duality of Purushas and they're not different among themselves?
No, see...
Eka Purusha Sarva Bhuteshu? This is what the Samkhya...
No, the thing is, you see, that's why I stressed that point also here. You see, the Advaita Vedantins never deny the Laukika Paramarthikatva of the world. For all practical purposes, the world is considered as such.
Avidya
Kalpita. Yeah. Avidya Kalpita. But you see, so much is the difference. Here in the Vedanta Viribhasha, two lines have been quoted. Pramanam tvatma nischayat. You see, the entire world is valid up to the moment you realize Brahman. You see, then the ultimate, as regards the ultimate reality, there is no objection. Ultimate reality is Brahman itself. But up to the point of realization of Brahman, The world is real.
Well, when you say up to the point, this up to the point is nothing but a concession that is made, obviously. You know, for the sake of the seeker. It's only a concession, not that there's any, again, as you did stress, that there's no such thing as grades of reality. It's not like the Buddhist idea that there is a paramarthika drishti and there is actually such thing as a vyavaharika drishti. There's no two satyas, right?
That's
also another thing that I think is clearly differentiates Shankara's darshana from Buddhist darshanas. Mm. There's no such thing as samvritti satya, paramarthika satya. These are not satyas. The so-called vyavaharika satya, and it's not called satya ever in the sutras as far as I know, there are only concessions being made from the viewpoint. There are superimposition, there are concessions being made only for the purpose of teaching. But of course they are negated at some point, always in the teaching they are negated. So I see there are very clear difference between these two.
Yeah, but it all depends on you how you approach the problem. For example, this statement itself, the concession. So you are now, as far as I understand from what you say, you are now on the part of the ultimate reality. You view things from the
viewpoint of Shankara, that's what it is. No, Shruti is there to lead one
that is another point which I am going to emphasize in my next lecture on Advaita Vedanta and the 19th century Kerala Renaissance. Because that philosopher, Sri Narayana Ruhu, did the same thing. You see, he never approached this problem from the standpoint of Shankara. He stood on the side of the practical reality, the real world, and looked at Brahman from that standpoint. You are okay, you are entirely correct when you look at things from the Brahman standpoint. But I also do not look at the entire principles of Advaita Vedanta, not from the standpoint of Brahman. I am not on the power, on the side of Brahman. I look at Brahman from the practical standpoint, namely the practical world, which is the Vyavaharika Satyam. So then, as for myself, I can understand. See, anyway, my path is not dedicated to realize Brahman. So as far as I do not take it as my ultimate aim, this world is real to me. And that is why, even in Advaita Vedanta, all the three types of realities are accepted.
No, I don't think they're accepted at all.
Vedanta Paribhasha is, a textbook. It's a Paribhasha. Paribhasha is a technical term used in Sanskrit. You see, when the Advaita Vedanta system was already standardized, of course its principles have been codified here.
Yeah.
So in it, you see, the three realities have been accepted.
I would agree, but these are obviously later texts. I was just thinking about early Advaitins. I think in the early Advaita tradition there's very little ground to make the assertion that you made, I think, between the Buddhist Siddhanta and the Advaita Siddhanta, I think very
good. Yeah, that's correct. In the beginning, of course, especially in Nakamura's book, these points have been stressed. So to that I also agree, because the Advaita Vedanta was not the same right from the beginning up to now. Mm. Of course, there has been a development. A history of development of the Advaita Vedantic system, as a result of the controversy between the Dvaitins and Advaitins. Of course, Advaita Vedanta also changed a lot. But even after taking into account all these facts, as regards the ultimate reality, there is no concession, as you put it. Of course, from the standpoint of the Shankarites or the Advaita Vedantins, there is no concession. For practical reality, for the practical reality of the world, etc., of course, there can be that kind of concession. But these things actually do not appeal to a person who views things from the practical side. It was that kind of a saint who also was a social leader, reform movement of Kerala, named Sri Narayana Guru. And he also has contributed a lot to the cause of Advaita Vedanta also. To his credit, he has also composed another Brahma Sutra, Vedanta Sutra. Only in some 14 sutras. A small book, but incorporating in itself all the principles of Advaita Vedanta. So, it all depends on how you approach the problem. So, you have options, so what you present from your viewpoint is correct. But when I approach this problem from the standpoint of the practical reality of the world, of course, I assign some sort of a concession.
Yes.
Yeah. Jonathan wanted something. Yeah. Okay.
Just briefly, I mean, that's an interesting thing anyway, and I've read, as you say, places where people have said, yes, Buddhism and Shankara are very close, and perhaps precisely the anti-Buddhist rhetoric is the rhetoric that you have, the arguments you have to make up against the people who stand closest to you so that you don't get confused with them. And it always seemed to me that some of the problems that the structures are very similar. The structures of reality, the structures of the absolute, and their relations and degrees are very similar, but there's a big difference in how you attribute the degrees of reality. And you want to say that, Shankara, there are no degrees of reality. There's one reality, and then there's a superimposition level which has no reality. But there's still kind of
degrees of reality are not, have no inherent existence.
Not real degrees.
But the Buddhists do, the Shunyavadins do hold that there are two satyas, and they truly exist. And that's why they're able to actually make the symbiosis. That's why they can say that Jyavaharika and Nirvana are one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they can assert that, but I don't think Shankara can make any assertion like that. I don't think it would.
I understand, although I think that's, again, I think if you look at it philosophically, that's a place where Shankara is making an assertion, and it's a fair assertion. I think that a lot of people would go, well, hold on what basis are you making that assertion? Are you saying something to make it, are you saying that it's so, even though you can't give us a complete philosophical account of why actually it would be different from what we're saying? I'm not saying that Shankara is wrong, but I think there are philosophical issues where you can say, you know, it's like the Christians coming in and saying, well, this is all different because it's the nature of the Trinity. And it's a theological, it's almost a mystical question for which the others may say, well, frankly, you're saying the same thing. It's just that you're claiming an extra separate philosophical assertion or category or nature to it, which, you know, frankly, where'd that come from? Again, I don't think Shankara's wrong. I just think that he's doing something philosophically to put himself outside of that scheme, which is a slightly odd move. Yes. But that wasn't my question. My question was partly about the Bhartrahari and Shankara comparison, where it's really appealing, but if Brahman is Shabda Brahman and already has a bit more like Prakriti, always has an innate potentiality for division, an innate potentiality for multiplicity in it. It seems to me that Shabda Brahman, an absolute reality that is of the nature of language, already has an innate capacity to be multiple. Whereas Shankara, and that's very philosophically satisfying. It makes much more sense, I think. It makes more sense because it makes it easier to account for reality.
For
the worldly reality.
Yes.
I agree, and I'm not saying that I don't prefer one or the other, but philosophically it's helpful. Shabda Brahman makes much more sense, and it's much more like the very various linguistic reality accounts that you get throughout philosophy. But Shankara isn't precisely the point that Shankara wants to say. It's not in any way potentiality. It's not in any way Shabda Brahman. It has no potentiality. Therefore, it's not a manifestation in Shankara, because you couldn't have, there's no potential for that. It's a superimposition. I think it gets Shankara into trouble philosophically, because he can't account for the superimposition.
That's
if you see what I mean.
That's why his theory is called Maya Satkaryavada.
Yeah.
And not Satkaryavada. Or you could say also Maya Vivartavada. That's how he differ. I think he would differentiate himself from Bhartrihari.
I
If you see a world, if you think there is a world, yes, Shankara teaches that that world originates from Brahman. If you think there is a world.
But how does it,
again,
but how does it originate? See, that's what I think is the difference, is that Bhartrahari is being very logical, and he puts the potentiality inside his notion of Brahman. With Shankara, he says it's not.
No, it is.
It's, well, then how does it happen?
Maybe Bhartrahari is more sort of objective. It has more of an objective origin. It's through grammar and language and Prakriti, whereas in Shankara, it's subjective. The origin of the world is subjective. There's nothing happening out there. It's happening in here.
But that's still,
that
I think, how...
They're concomitant. You see, as we said yesterday over lunch, Shankara's idea is that if there is a mind, there is a world. You can never find one without the other. They're concomitant.
But where does the mind come from? The mind is innate in the chitta of Brahman, in which case the world is innate in the chitta of Brahman.
This is from a realistic viewpoint where you're really trying to get into causality.
Yeah.
Shankara is not interested in going there.
That's the correct angle. You see, how you approach things from the reality. If you are on the side of this reality and view things from that angle, of course the views will be different. But when he or Shankara, I think he is exactly on the side of Shankara. I am not exactly on the side of Shankara. That's the so much of difference is there. I have always looked at Shankara from a from a different standpoint. I have never stood along with Shankara. And actually speaking, my own people, because I have I am lenient towards materialism. So my own materialist people say, you always try to defend Shankara. But that's not actually true. I have never tried to defend Shankara. But whatever Shankara says in this manner, if you say that there is a world, of course its origin must be of this. That is there. It's actually speaking not his contribution. It is there in the Upanishads as well as the Bhagavad Gita. Also, that view is there. But as Jessica put it, of course Bhartrihari's approach seems to be more logical. Because, you see, this kind of a subjective approach is lacking in Bhartrihari. He has got more, his approach is more objective. In that sense, I also agree with you. Of course, Bhartrihari is more objective than Shankara. You are also correct in this in this matter. Shankara approaches. Then, concerning the comparison between Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta, of course, it somehow came here by way of our discussion, and I have not prepared much on this aspect. Of course, there are many things to be read in this connection. Exactly speaking, the Samvruti concept itself has taken shape of the Maya concept. You see, Shankara's Maya concept is no invention of his.
Well, again, I would like to know how you understand the Maya concept in Shankara, because it's obviously a very, but I mean, maybe off the.
It's a big subject. A comparative study of this Samvruti and Maya itself will be a big subject, of course. But such viewpoints are also there. Shankara's
terms are there, that's right. But you think that the way Buddhists use the term Maya and the way Shankara uses Maya is exactly the same?
No, there are several difficulties. For example, you see, have you read the book on Buddhism by Ambedkar, The Buddha and His Dharma? If you go through the book of Ambedkar named The Buddha and His Dharma, your entire approach to Buddhism will change. Because, you see, there are many difficulties concerning the understanding of original Buddhism. See, we now depend on mainly the Tripitaka. And these Tripitaka themselves are not original Buddhist literature. The first council which met to give shape to the principles enunciated by Buddha could not reach a conclusion. It was only in the third council that some sort of an agreement, it was no full agreement, some sort of an agreement was reached. And as a result, the present Tripitaka, and the present Tripitaka also has three main versions, namely the Indian version, the Tibetan version, and also the Burmese. See, they all differ. Even then, you see, what we see in Tripitaka is to some extent distorted versions of original preachings of the Buddha.
Who will never know?
other literature, secondary literature on which we depend also have distorted a lot. In Ambedkar's study, we come closer to Buddha. I also don't say that his is the most authentic. He had also several limitations, but he did his level best to understand Buddhism from his necessity standpoint, because he at last took to Buddhism and he converted a lot of our Dalits into Buddhism too.
Mm-hmm.
So he approached Buddha differently from the standpoints adopted by the other authors who approached him. And this book is actually speaking, is enlightening, Buddha and his Dharma, from which we can understand that Buddha was never preoccupied with any kind of approach to reality. When one approaches Shankara from the standpoint of Shankara, of course, Shankara is correct. I also agree with this. For some years, I also had this kind of an approach, but later it changed. When I had this view, of course, I also defended in the same manner as you do at the moment.
I can
progress. Yeah.
Just more of a philosophical take on the problem. You said the ultimate reality is the same in Vijñānavādins as it is in Shankara. Ultimately, they're talking about the same thing. It comes up in modern issues of consciousness studies and religious experience, mystical experience, where you get scholars that want to say what a Christian mystic is experiences is the same thing as what a Buddhist is experiencing, or when you excite a particular part of the brain, then you can have just a regular scientist have the same experience that a nun will have, or an Orthodox monk. I think that's naive, because what you're doing is you're trying to compare with texts. You're comparing what Shankara said about Brahman, and you're comparing what the Buddha say about whatever, Shunyata, or their ultimate reality.
Ultimate reality.
Whatever they say, whatever the different schools are using. And we have access to their text and their words they're using, but we don't have access to their experience. And what they're doing is they're talking about, we think, their experience.
Yeah.
And if you're not part of the tradition and practicing that tradition, then I think it's very difficult to actually access the text and actually access what they're really talking about. And even if you think I think we can get some philosophical understanding and intuition and feeling of what a different particular school is talking about, or a particular author. But it seems very difficult to have enough access to that to say what A is talking about is the same thing as what B is talking about. What Shankar is talking about is the same thing as what the Buddhist, or what, you know, Christian mystic is the same as a Hindu Swami, whatever the case.
It seems that there is some sort of an attempt to mystify things. Yeah.
Yes.
Surely there is.
Because
he,
yeah.
Because how can
we practice Advaita Vedanta? You see, when we take this into account, of course, there are many other points to be considered. For example, you see, there is one site in the name of, one website in the name of Shankara, where there is a discussion list also, to which I wanted to join. But then there came the question. I should solemnly affirm that I should never speak any word against Shankara. Then only I'll be admitted. I decided not to join.
It's not mandatory, is it?
Yeah. See, similarly, you see, Shankara's Advaita, in Shankara's Advaita, you see, the ultimate reality is Brahman. Everything is Brahman. As was put, I don't exactly remember your name.
Jamari.
Yeah. You see, the entire reality is actually speaking Brahman. Then how can there be distinction among, especially the human beings? But in the Brahma Sutra, especially the Apashudra Adhikarna, Shankara has gone to the extent of denying right to the Shudras in the matter of learning the Vedas.
Yes.
So, and some say, no, it is actually, it was not actually written by Shankara.
Mm.
It's an interrupt. No, no.
No, I would agree with that.
No, no, we cannot say, because not only Shankara, other commentators also have commented on Apashudra Adhikarna. So, and even now, that's another fact. Even now, is in the Shankara mutts, let us,
we'll avoid the
Kanjipuram, because at least in all the four mutts,
yes,
established, original mutts established by, because there is that kind of a view also. The Kanji mutt was never established by Shankara. Yeah, even in those mutts, still this Varna Vetyasa is adhered to. How is it now?
I heard in his commentary on the Gita, on Chaturvarnyamaya Shishtam, this verse,
yes,
he said that Varna is established by Janma.
By birth?
Yeah, by birth. Yeah. Your Varna comes from your Janma.
He was a product of his time.
Shamari's not upholding his social tenets, just his philosophy.
Yeah.
No, but he had another way. I don't feel like he denied actually the knowledge to any other people than the proper people who have the adhikari twa for receiving the teachings. But I think he obviously had the other way around, where I don't think he was very keen on saying, seeing the Upanishads as the only pramana. The Upanishads are the pramanas, but what does he mean by Upanishad? Is it just those texts, those specific texts that you call, that we now have in the form of those, 13 main Upanishads? I feel like his understanding went beyond that, and I think that's why he was able to accommodate, while not frustrating, I think, the Brahminical milieu, he was able to accommodate also the Shudras and the others. Actually, I think he was holding the view that they could also access the truth if they had the mind for it, but by many other ways. The Bhagavad Gita study, for example, or simply by meeting someone who would reveal, to those person the truth of Atman.
But
so I think he held two views about Upanishads. Upanishads are not just a sacred revelation, from which the Shudras are denied. I don't think that's the only way he understood Upanishads. continue to Upanishads are as teachings which have go beyond the idea that, yes, it is a mystical language, Sanskrit, you know, and these texts are only to be found in the Vedic revelation.
And see, the study of Sanskrit itself was prohibited for the Lokas, including the Sudras.
Yes, yes.
Then what explanation is there? So it does not and politically even
That's why it didn't go against that officially.
This goes against the fundamental principles of Advaita Vedanta. So that was why you see in my state, you see another leader like Sri Narayana Guru. There was another leader who never gave shape to any movement. But who wrote a lot, and he has written a primer of Advaita Vedanta also, which is called Advaita Chinta Paddhati, which was originally written in Malayalam, and it has been translated into Sanskrit, and I have published it. I have given a copy to this library, Advaita Chinta Paddhati. And he has, to his credit, another work called Vedadhikara Nirupanam, in which he, after putting forward evidences from the Vedic sources themselves, argues that what Shankara has done is wrong. Quoting Brahma Sutra, Apashudra Adhikarna, he has established that the Shudras are, for example, Vidura. He cites the example of Vidura, who actually speaking was a Shudra. But Vidura's polity is even today taught in our classes, school classes, Vidura Niti. So you see, what Shankara actually preached, not only the original Adi Shankara, the present day Shankaracharyas also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes they visit different places. I have seen Shankaracharya of Shringeri coming into Trivandrum. You see, when he travels, of course, there will be a huge row of his paraphernalia, like the president or prime minister when he moves this way. And you see, these Brahmins, they form a chain and let no one else go inside it. Keeping this kind of a fencing that nobody touches this Shankaracharya. And also, in his Sringeri, of course, every year the scholars assemble and discussions, etc., are there. And for non-Brahmin scholars, there is separate place. They cannot enter and mingle with the Brahmins. So such things are even practiced even today, and they never have spared anything in objecting to Dvaitins. See, the Dvaita Mats also are there in Karnataka. They also have these kinds of Mats, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And they have never spared anything to deny Dvaita Vedanta and established Advaita Vedanta. And these Shankaracharyas trying to establish Advaita Vedanta and practicing Chaturvarti. This, that.
I'm going to be a bit teased. I'm willing to accept that philosophers may preach one thing and preach social and political positions that are different from what is actually commensurate with their philosophy. It happens all the time, unfortunately. I'm still concerned about the notion that perhaps Bhartrihari's Advaita Vedanta is more logical or rational or reasonable, and that Shankara's is in some sense not. So I'm going to go back to that place, which I'm still not clear about, because I'd like to be clear on whether Shankara's notion is asserting something for which he's not ready to give a reason, a logical account. He's just going to say it is like this, and that's it. Well, you said that where there is mind, there is world.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. How do we not then say that where Brahman is Satchitananda, that there is not world in some sense, and it's the in some sense part of it that's very complicated, but that there's not world in some sense in potentio within the chit, which is Brahman. I mean, in what way do you, can you still make that radical distinction between the one reality and the other? How is Brahman remain absolutely pure and absolutely separate from Maya, from world, if the very nature of chit is something that has the potential for world? You know, where is mind is world? How then can we have a Brahman that is absolute in Shankara's vision of things?
No, the main drawback is that, as was put by Janathan, you see, in these matters, there is no point in actually speaking. The ultimate
but then
reality.
It's not philosophical. He's not being.
No,
which is
a
okay.
Peculiar. That's the most complicated thing. You see, actually speaking, what the Upanishad say, Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa saha. So, we cannot apply our mind on Brahman. It's beyond.
It's beyond.
It's beyond.
And
it's beyond
and understanding,
yeah.
And causal analysis.
Actually speaking, that is why I do not stand on. Yeah.
At the same time, if I may add,
I just want to clarify if that's really the position, absolutely. Because then he's doing
well,
that theological thing.
I think it's
stopped.
A huge question that you bring up, and it would take probably a lot of time to go through that. But I feel at the same time, if Shankara, it depends again how you feel when you say it's not philosophy. Well, what is philosophy? Is what Shankara is interested is to point as far as this problem. The problem that you're pointing at is a problem of ignorance, right? Because if you see a world, it's because you're ignorant of the reality. So then you have to investigate what ignorance is in Shankara Vedanta, which is a big thing. So, but at least when he has to deal with this problem, he doesn't look at it as a philosophical problem in a strict sense of the term, or as a metaphysical problem. But he takes it as a, very simply, I think, as an experiential problem.
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that we experience? It's enough. You know that, every time you wake up in the morning, the first thing, when you open your eyes, duality comes.
Mm-hmm.
I, you.
Yes.
This is exactly how it begins.
It's the nature of consciousness.
It comes,
it's a
and they're actually
analysis.
They're simultaneous. You see,
yes.
The duality between subject, the mind, and the
it's
world.
It's in the very nature of consciousness itself.
That's right. They're just kind of like they come about. Now, why, if you're trying to find a cause for it within the bounds of reason, I think you fail, and I think the post-Shankara Vedanta have failed to do that.
There's tons
of literature trying to explain that.
I'm just trying to identify a moment in which, having made account of the nature of Brahman, having made account of the nature of Maya, having made account of the nature of Vidya to some extent, there's a moment at which he says, but we can't make account for this. And
for what? For the appearance of the world?
For the notion that consciousness is of the nature of self and other. This whole notion of what the witness is.
No, it's,
witness
no, it's not. Why is it not? Because those things that appear in consciousness, they don't last. You see, the reality, and you would have, I guess, ultimately to agree with this, but reality for Shankara is that which never alters its nature. Now, the very fact that this waking world come about as soon as we open our eyes in the morning, and that it disappears entirely, the subject and the object, at night, when dream comes about, this shows the unreality of both the subject and object, because they're not permanent.
This
similarly,
it's all established on the basis of experience.
Yes, it's an experiential problem. Now, if you want to try to find a reason for that, I think you bring the problem from an experiential domain to a metaphysical domain.
But he
and
himself
then
took
you
it into
swimming.
The metaphysical domain. I agree, and I think that the key here is that he's talking about what he really wants to say when he says Brahman is something to do with, as you say, that which doesn't change, the ontological essence itself, the fact of the being, not the
it's
nature
not even
of the being.
Ontology, because ontology is always within time and space.
Yeah, well,
time and space,
that's
the time
that's
and space of the waking
yes.
also is included. It's not that consciousness is in time and space.
Yeah, but
it's not ontology.
When I use ontology, I don't mean time and space necessarily. That would be. I understand what you're saying, but I think he wants to talk about the fact of existence, and you can bring a lot to bear on the word existence, but the fact of it is unchanging and absolute and totally unaffected by the particular variations, the vrittis, the manifestations of dualities or whatever. And then you can have long series of arguments about whether it's manifestation or superimposition, and it's fair to say that perhaps we can't make an argument about it because all we have is our experience. You know, that's the phenomenological problem of trying to do metaphysics from experience. That's fine. But I just feel a little bit like where Shankara wants to give an account of everything else, and he's willing to talk to some extent about the nature of Brahman. He's not willing to talk about the relationship of experience to the larger metaphysics that he's painting, to the larger assertions that he's making, even though his assertions, when you come back to it, are always based on experience.
It is. If that is not experiential, nothing else is experiential, and everything derives from that. That's why this preamble of the Vedanta story is so important, because he specifically says this adhyasa is a mutual mixing up of self and not self. It's exactly what's happening. So that, you know, the object and the subject, which are ever opposed, their nature and their qualities are totally opposed, just like the light and darkness are opposed. He says this happens to each and every one of us, and it's naisargika. It's absolutely natural. So even though they're totally opposite, he says, nevertheless, it is the common experience of everyone to mistake, you know, the non-self for the self and the self for the non-self. From that, he says, vyavaharika as well as vaidika dealings. So all religious as well as empirical dealings proceed. So that is the source. That source from which all the shastra actually based on, all the teachings, the guru, the shishya, the possibility of liberation, the actuality of bondage, all these things actually derive from this very important premise, which is this adhyasa. And that is established experientially. So,
But the thing is, you see, then I think this trust should be on the epistemological side. You see, it all depends on how you take these things into account. You made a statement that by chance it also is interesting to me. You said that to Shankara, reality is that which never changes. To Shankara, yeah. But in one of my papers, in which I am going to approach Advaita from the materialistic as well as the Advaita Vedantic. Advaita, Vedantic and materialistic. That is one of my papers, which I am going to present here. You see, the opposite to me, the opposite is the truth. That which ever changes is true.
I think the lines are very fine, and they're often interpretative, and they're where you want to stop doing a kind of rational analysis, and where you want to, I mean, I think there's a lot in here which is philosophy, where we have the same system, the same structure of analysis, but different judgments being made, and different places where people want to stop or keep going.
Then my question is it not that Shankara's philosophy is something closed? For example, in the Ayurvedic prescriptions, you can see several prescriptions which can never be, you see, applied. So such with regard to such prescriptions, we cannot say anything. We cannot simply say that it's absurd. No, we have not tested it. And we are not in a position to test it also. For example, in the skull of a person who died 10,000 years ago, you know, how can it be practiced? It's not possible. Similarly, several. For example, I went through the Sharangathara Samhita, in which several rare prescriptions are there, apart from the Ashtanga Hridaya, etc. In the Sharangathara Samhita, there are many prescriptions. And in Nalacharita, Naishati, no, Naishati. No, in the Mahakavya, Sanskrit Mahakavya, Nala, Naishatiya Charita. In the Naishatiya Charita, there is a part where Nala goes to the harem of Damayanti, taking this particular way named the Tiraskarini. The Tiraskarini is such a magic that you can see everyone. He will not be seen by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So, by using this Tiraskarini, Nala goes to the harem of Damayanti. You see, in the harem, of course, women alone will be admitted. But Nala, the king, he goes using Tiraskarini. See, in the same manner, there is one prescription in the Sharangathara Samhita, a medicine to be prepared and applied. But how can we apply it? You see, that medicine can be prepared, and after applying that medicine, you can move around and you will not be seen by anyone. You can see everyone. But how can it be tested? It cannot be. It cannot be. In the same manner, you see, of course, it's all okay with Advaita Brahman or Vedantic Brahman, Advaita Vedantic Brahman. Once one realizes it. But there is no surety to that effect. For example, in the Vedanta itself, of course, the prescription is there, the Sadhana Chatushtaya. And even in the Sadhana Chatushtaya, Viveka Chudamani is ascribed to Shankaracharya. Even in the Sadhana Chatushtaya, he has made it clear that Jantunam Narajanma Dullapham Atah Pumstvam Tato Viprata. He you see, yeah, distinguishes between the other beasts and the human being. Then among human beings, distinction between man and woman. Jandunam narajanma dullabham atah pumstva. To be born as a man is better than being born as a woman. Tato viprada. Then to be born as a Brahmin is further, better. Tasmad Vaidika Dharma Marga. So these kinds of distinctions have been accepted on the practical level. And then speaking about. So in principle it's okay. Then what is to be mainly considered is the theory of knowledge. Of course, this is one. Actually speaking, this is an one way. The Vedantic Brahman cannot be simply tested. You cannot simply make a test of Advaita Vedantic
Brahman.
Test. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought it was all about testing.
You cannot test it.
Scientific test.
You cannot test it because Shankara himself has barred us, non-Brahmins.
You can't, from the outside, you can't test it.
That's what he's saying, that non-Brahmins don't have, they can't.
The Upanishads are filled with this. I mean, we have women receiving or challenging Brahmins.
They receive
the teaching. They're able to challenge the Brahmins. They're the best philosophers in the Vyadaranyaka Upanishad. So to say that they're, non-Brahmins are barred from this, I'm not convinced. Plus, I think that many times when Shankara used the term Brahmanas, I don't think he has in mind necessarily the Brahmins as the caste. I'm not always convinced of that. I think there's a lot of cues to show the universality of the Vedantic teachings rather than a very elitist cluster of teaching.
Now what I say is the opposite. You see, even in Shankara Mutts, this is practiced. And in our society, we have been subjected to this for the last several hundreds of years.
It's 1400 years after Chakra's time. So, of course, let's
no extraordinary. and for example,
no politics.
Yeah, in my case, of course, this Chattambi Swami, who belonged to my community. And also, there is a very interesting thing. Is when these I did actually speaking, I belong to the southern part of India, and the South India is actually speaking separate from the North India. We belong to the Dravidian folk. And when the Aryan escalation took place, because the Aryans came to our part, and my caste was branded as Shudras by them. But there was no hesitation on their part to accept our women folk as their wives.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a particular kind of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
See, a Brahmin, in a Brahmin family, you see, the eldest one alone will marry from the Brahmin, their family. And the others, the younger ones, they will never marry a Brahmin lady. They should not. Because it's because otherwise the wealth of the family will be divided. It's because of that. And these younger ones, they can have, which is called Sambandha. Sambandha. They can have Sambandha with Nair women. Any number. And they have no obligation at all. They have, give a cloth to a Nair lady.
Mm.
Then she becomes his wife. And the progeny has no right at all. This was right. And this Chattambi Swamigal, he himself was a product of this time. Because his father was a Brahmin. And his mother was a servant in a Brahmin family. And to her, he was born from a Brahmin father. And there was no obligation for him. So he, from his own experience, realized these things, and he retorted against these kinds of arguments by Shankaracharya, etc. So in principle, Bhartrihari and Shankara have no difference at all as regards the ultimate reality.
Today we couldn't even
say
that because I had lots of questions and remarks to make.
Yeah. Whether you say it's Shabda Brahman or Sachidananda Brahman, Brahman is absolutely real. Brahman is the only absolute reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire world is its vivarta. And in this, both Bhartrihari and Shankara agree. There are no difference of opinion at all. Whether Brahman is Shabda Brahman or mere Brahman. Only in this, there is a difference of opinion among Shankara and Bhartrihari. Bhartrihari says that it's Shabda Brahman. Shankara says it's Brahman. That's all. And, you see, concerning the vivarta nature of universe, of course, I have mentioned in this, some scholars have pointed out that actually the word vivarta used in Bhartrihari's Vakyapatiya is not strictly in the sense in which Shankara used the word in his literature. So Richard King in his book, he has used another word for this vivarta, unrolling. Yes, you with a knot, unrolling.
Mm.
Yeah, in dealing with Bhartrihari, he
What's
has
the Sanskrit word for unrolling.
Actually, it is unrolling. The same word in vivarta can mean the
same. Another English meaning.
Instead of this superimposition, he uses this word unrolling. But that also is not an alien concept.
I see a huge difference when you speak. You seem to be using those terms interchangeably: superimposition and illusory manifestation.
It's two different things.
It's two different things. I mean, yes and no, but I think it needs
but anyway,
maybe it's too late.
No, you're welcome to go.
Okay.
We finished. No, even though we proceed further a little.
Let us formally finish.
Yeah.
Okay. And then
finish.
Informally carry on.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. You can proceed. Yeah.
I have two questions
for
both of you. Thank you. What, first of all, and this has never been totally clear to me, in Satchidananda.
Satchidananda, yeah.
What exactly is meant by Ananda?
Ananda.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not Ananda. Ananda is different.
Sorry.
Ananda.
Ananda.
Yeah.
What is meant by Ananda? In English, we always translate this, but this word is completely almost meaningless in English. And I don't think it's, you know, it doesn't fit very well into the metaphysics.
You see, I'm not in a position to supply you with an exact English word.
Mm.
Perhaps they will not.